Sulu, and seven of my former Robben Island comrades, Raymond Mhlaba, Ahmed Kathrada, Andrew Mlangeni, Elias Motsoaledi, Jeff Masimola, Wilton Mkwayi, and Oscar Mpeta, were to be released. That morning, I had been visited by Walter, Kathy, Ray, and Andrew, who were still at Paulsmoor, and I was able to say goodbye. It was an emotional moment, but I knew I would not be too far behind. The men were released 5 days later from Johannesburg prison. It was an action that rightly evoked praise here and abroad, and I conveyed my appreciation to Mr. de Klerk. But my gratitude paled compared to my unalloyed joy that Walter and the others were free. It was a day we had yearned for and fought for over so many years. De Klerk had lived up to his promise, and the men were released under no bans. They could speak in the name of the ANC. It was clear that the ban on the organization had effectively expired, a vindication of our long struggle and our resolute adherence to principle. De Klerk began a systematic dismantling of many of the building blocks of apartheid. He opened South African beaches to people of all colors and stated that the Reservation of Separate Amenities Act would soon be repealed. Since 1953, this act had enforced what was known as petty apartheid, segregating parks, theaters, restaurants, buses, libraries, toilets, and other public facilities according to race. In November, he announced that the National Security Management System, a secret structure set up under P.W. Botha to combat anti-apartheid forces, would be dissolved. In early December, I was informed that a meeting with de Klerk was set for the 12th of that month. By this time, I was able to consult with my colleagues new and old, and I had meetings at the cottage with my old colleagues and the leaders of the Mass Democratic Movement and the UDF. I received ANC people from all of the regions, as well as delegates from the UDF and COSATU. One of these young men was Cyril Ramaphosa, the General Secretary of the National Union of Mine Workers, and one of the ablest of the new generation of leadership. I also had visits from colleagues of mine from Robben Island, including Terra Lakota and Tokyo Sexwale, who stayed to lunch. They are both men with large appetites, and the only complaint I heard about them was from Warrant Officer Swart, who said, "Those fellows will eat us out of house and home." With guidance from a number of colleagues, I then drafted a letter to de Klerk, not unlike the one I had sent to P.W. Botha. The subject was talks between the government and the ANC. I told the president that the current conflict was draining South Africa's lifeblood, and talks were the only solution. I said the ANC would accept no preconditions to talks, especially not the precondition that the government wanted, the suspension of the armed struggle. The government asked for an honest commitment to peace, and I pointed out that our readiness to negotiate was exactly that. I told Mr. de Klerk how impressed I was by his emphasis on reconciliation, enunciated in his inaugural address. His words had imbued millions of South Africans and people around the world with the hope that a new South Africa was about to be born. The very first step on the road to reconciliation, I said, was the complete dismantling of apartheid and all the measures used to enforce it. But I said that the spirit of that speech had not been much in evidence of late. The government's policies were perceived by many as a continuation of apartheid by other means. The government, I said, had spent too much time talking with black homeland leaders and others co-opted by the system. These men, I asserted, were the agents of an oppressive past that the mass of black South Africans rejected. I reiterated my proposal that talks take place in two stages. I told him I fully supported the guidelines the ANC had adopted in the Harare Declaration of 1989, which put the onus on the government to eliminate the obstacles to negotiations that the state itself had created. Those demands included the release of all political prisoners, the lifting of all bans on restricted organizations and persons, the end to the state of emergency, and the removal of all troops from the townships. I stressed that a mutually agreed-upon ceasefire to end hostilities ought to be the first order of business, for without that, no business could be conducted. The day before our meeting, the letter was delivered to Mr. de Klerk. On the morning of December 13th, I was again taken to Twenways. I met de Klerk in the same room where I had had tea with his predecessor. Mr. de Klerk was accompanied by Kobi Coetzee, General Willemse, Dr. Barnard, and his colleague Mike Liu. I congratulated Mr. de Klerk on becoming president and expressed the hope that we would be able to work together. He was extremely cordial and reciprocated these sentiments. From the first I noticed that Mr. de Klerk listened to what I had to say. This was a novel experience. National Party leaders generally heard what they wanted to hear in discussions with black leaders, but Mr. de Klerk seemed to be making an attempt to truly understand. One of the issues I emphasized that day was the National Party's recently introduced 5-year plan, which contained the concept of group rights. The idea of group rights was that no racial or ethnic group could take precedence over any other. Although they defined group rights as a way of protecting the freedom of minorities in a new South Africa, in fact, their proposal was a means of preserving white domination. I told Mr. de Klerk that this was unacceptable to the ANC. I added that it was not in his interest to retain this concept, for it gave the impression that he wanted to modernize apartheid without abandoning it. This was damaging his image and that of the National Party in the eyes of the progressive forces in this country and around the world. An oppressive system cannot be reformed, I said. It must be entirely cast aside. I mentioned an editorial that I had recently read in Die Burger, the mouthpiece of the National Party in the Cape, implying that the group rights concept was conceived as an attempt to bring back apartheid through the back door. I told Mr. de Klerk that if that was how his party's paper perceived group rights, how did he think we regarded it? I added that the ANC had not struggled against apartheid for 75 years, only to yield to a disguised form of it, and that if it was his true intention to preserve apartheid through the Trojan horse of group rights, then he did not truly believe in ending apartheid. Mr. de Klerk, I saw that day, does not react quickly to things. It was a mark of the man that he listened to what I had to say and did not argue with me. "You know," he said, "my aim is no different than yours. Your memo to P.W. Botha said the ANC and the government should work together to deal with white fears of black domination, and the idea of group rights is how we propose to deal with it." I was impressed with this response, but said that the idea of group rights did more to increase black fears than allay white ones. De Klerk then said, "We will have to change it then." I then brought up the question of my freedom, and said that if he expected me to go out to pasture upon my release, he was greatly mistaken. I reaffirmed that if I was released into the same conditions under which I had been arrested, I would go back to doing precisely those things for which I had been imprisoned. I made the case to him that the best way to move forward was to unban the ANC and all other political organizations, to lift the state of emergency, to release political prisoners, and to allow the exiles to return. If the government did not unban the ANC, as soon as I was out of prison, I would be working for an illegal organization. "Then," I said, "you must simply rearrest me after I walk through those gates." Again, he listened carefully to what I had to say. My suggestion certainly came as no surprise to him. He said he would take all that I said under consideration, but that he would make no promises. The meeting was an exploratory one, and I understood that nothing was going to be resolved that day. But it was extremely useful, for I had taken the measure of Mr. de Klerk just as I did with new prison commanders when I was on Robben Island. I was able to write to our people in Lusaka that Mr. de Klerk seemed to represent a true departure from the National Party politicians of the past. Mr. de Klerk, I said, echoing Mrs. Thatcher's famous description of Mr. Gorbachev, was a man we could do business with. Chapter 99. On February 2, 1990, F.W. de Klerk stood before Parliament to make the traditional opening speech and did something no other South African head of state had ever done. He truly began to dismantle the apartheid system and lay the groundwork for a democratic South Africa. In dramatic fashion, Mr. de Klerk announced the lifting of the bans on the ANC, the PAC, the South African Communist Party, and 31 other illegal organizations. The freeing of political prisoners incarcerated for non-violent activities, the suspension of capital punishment, and the lifting of various restrictions imposed by the state of emergency. "The time for negotiation has arrived," he said. It was a breathtaking moment, for in one sweeping action he had virtually normalized the situation in South Africa. Our world had changed overnight. After 40 years of persecution and banishment, the ANC was now a legal organization. I and all my comrades could no longer be arrested for being a member of the ANC, for carrying its green, yellow, and black banner, for speaking its name. For the first time in almost 30 years, my picture and my words and those of all my band comrades could freely appear in South African newspapers. The international community applauded de Klerk's bold actions. Amidst all the good news, however, the ANC objected to the fact that Mr. de Klerk had not completely lifted the state of emergency or ordered the troops out of the townships. On February 9th, 7 days after Mr. de Klerk's speech opening Parliament, I was informed that I was again going to Tuenwes. I arrived at 6 o'clock in the evening. I met a smiling Mr. de Klerk in his office, and as we shook hands, he informed me that he was going to release me from prison the following day. Although the press in South Africa and around the world had been speculating for weeks that my release was imminent, Mr. de Klerk's announcement nevertheless came as a surprise to me. I had not been told that the reason Mr. de Klerk wanted to see me was to tell me that he was making me a free man. I felt a conflict between my blood and my brain. I deeply wanted to leave prison as soon as I could, but to do so on such short notice would not be wise. I thanked Mr. de Klerk and then said that at the risk of appearing ungrateful, I would prefer to have a week's notice in order that my family and my organization could be prepared for my release. Simply to walk out tomorrow, I said, would cause chaos. I asked Mr. de Klerk to release me a week from that day. After waiting 27 years, I could certainly wait another 7 days. De Klerk was taken aback by my response. Instead of replying, he continued to relate the plan for my release. He said that the government would fly me to Johannesburg and officially release me there. Before he went any further, I told him that I strongly objected to that. I wanted to walk out of the gates of Victor Verster and be able to thank those who looked after me and greet the people of Cape Town. Though I was from Johannesburg, Cape Town had been my home for nearly 3 decades. I would make my way back to Johannesburg, but when I chose to, not when the government wanted me to. "Once I am free," I said, "I will look after myself." De Klerk was again nonplussed, but this time my objections caused a reaction. He excused himself and left his office to consult with others. After 10 minutes, he returned with a rather long face and said, "Mr. Mandela, it is too late to change the plan now." I replied that the plan was unacceptable and that I wanted to be released a week hence and at Victor Verster, not Johannesburg. It was a tense moment, and, at the time, neither of us saw any irony in a prisoner asking not to be released and his jailer attempting to release him. De Klerk again excused himself and left the room. After 10 minutes, he returned with a compromise. Yes, I could be released at Victor Förster, but no, the release could not be postponed. The government had already informed the foreign press that I was to be set free tomorrow, and felt they could not renege on that statement. I felt I could not argue with that. In the end, we agreed on the compromise, and Mr. de Klerk poured a tumbler of whiskey for each of us to drink in celebration. I raised the glass in a toast, but only pretended to drink. Such spirits are too strong for me. I did not get back to my cottage until shortly before midnight, whereupon I immediately sent word to my colleagues in Cape Town that I was to be released the following day. I managed to get a message to Winnie, and I telephoned Walter in Johannesburg. They would all fly in on a chartered plane the next day. That evening, a number of ANC people on what was known as the National Reception Committee came to the cottage to draft a statement that I would make the following day. They left in the early hours of the morning, and despite my excitement, I had no trouble falling asleep. Part 11. Freedom. Chapter 100. I awoke on the day of my release after only a few hours' sleep at 4:30 a.m. February 11th was a cloudless end-of-summer Cape Town day. I did a shortened version of my usual exercise regimen, washed, and ate breakfast. I then telephoned a number of people from the ANC and the UDF in Cape Town to come to the cottage to prepare for my release and work on my speech. The prison doctor came by to give me a brief checkup. I did not dwell on the prospect of my release, but on all the many things I had to do before then. As so often happens in life, the momentousness of an occasion is lost in the welter of a thousand details. There were numerous matters that had to be discussed and resolved with very little time to do so. A number of comrades from the reception committee, including Cyril Ramaphosa and Trevor Manuel, were at the house bright and early. I wanted initially to address the people of Parle, who had been very kind to me during my incarceration, but the reception committee was adamant that that would not be a good idea. It would look curious if I gave my first speech to the prosperous white burghers of Parle. Instead, as planned, I would speak first to the people of Cape Town, at the Grand Parade in Cape Town. One of the first questions to be resolved was where I would spend my first night of freedom. My inclination was to spend the night in the Cape Flats, the bustling black and colored townships of Cape Town, in order to show my solidarity with the people. But my colleagues, and later my wife, argued that for security reasons I should stay with Archbishop Desmond Tutu in Bishop's Court, a plush residence in a white suburb. It was not an area where I would have been permitted to live before I went to prison, and I thought it would send the wrong signal to spend my first night of freedom in a posh white area. But the members of the committee explained that Bishop's Court had become multiracial under Tutu's tenure and symbolized an open, generous non-racialism. The prison service supplied me with boxes and crates for packing. During my first 20 or so years in prison, I accumulated very few possessions. But in the last few years, I had amassed enough property, mainly books and papers, to make up for the previous decades. I filled over a dozen crates and boxes. My actual release time was set for 3 p.m., but Winnie and Walter and the other passengers from the chartered flight from Johannesburg did not arrive until after 2. There were already dozens of people at the house, and the entire scene took on the aspect of a celebration. Warrant Officer Swart prepared a final meal for all of us, and I thanked him not only for the food he had provided for the last 2 years, but the companionship. Warrant Officer James Gregory was also there at the house, and I embraced him warmly. In the years that he had looked after me from Polesmoor through Victor Förster, we had never discussed politics, but our bond was an unspoken one, and I would miss his soothing presence. Men like SWAT, Gregory, and Warrant Officer Brand reinforced my belief in the essential humanity even of those who had kept me behind bars for the previous 27.5 years. There was little time for lengthy farewells. The plan was that Winnie and I would be driven in a car to the front gate of the prison. I had told the authorities that I wanted to be able to say goodbye to the guards and warders who had looked after me, and I asked that they and their families wait for me at the front gate, where I would be able to thank them individually. At a few minutes after 3, I was telephoned by a well-known SABC presenter who requested that I get out of the car a few hundred feet before the gate so that they could film me walking toward freedom. This seemed reasonable, and I agreed to do it. This was my first inkling that things might not go as calmly as I had imagined. By 3:30, I began to get restless, as we were already behind schedule. I told the members of the reception committee that my people had been waiting for me for 27 years, and I did not want to keep them waiting any longer. Shortly before 4, we left in a small motorcade from the cottage. About a quarter of a mile in front of the gate, the car slowed to a stop, and Winnie and I got out and began to walk toward the prison gate. At first, I could not really make out what was going on in front of us, but when I was within 150 feet or so, I saw a tremendous commotion and a great crowd of people, hundreds of photographers and television cameras and news people, as well as several thousand well-wishers. I was astounded and a little bit alarmed. I had truly not expected such a scene. At most, I had imagined that there would be several dozen people, mainly the warders and their families. But this proved to be only the beginning. I realized we had not thoroughly prepared for all that was about to happen. Within 20 feet or so of the gate, the cameras started clicking, a noise that sounded like some great herd of metallic beasts. Reporters started shouting questions. Television crews began crowding in. ANC supporters were yelling and cheering. It was a happy, if slightly disorienting, chaos. When a television crew thrust a long, dark, furry object at me, I recoiled slightly, wondering if it were some newfangled weapon developed while I was in prison. Winnie informed me that it was a microphone. When I was among the crowd, I raised my right fist, and there was a roar. I had not been able to do that for 27 years, and it gave me a surge of strength and joy. We stayed among the crowd for only a few minutes before jumping back into the car for the drive to Cape Town. Although I was pleased to have such a reception, I was greatly vexed by the fact that I did not have a chance to say goodbye to the prison staff. As I finally walked through those gates to enter a car on the other side, I felt, even at the age of 71, that my life was beginning anew. My 10,000 days of imprisonment were over. Cape Town was 35 miles to the southwest, but because of the unexpected crowds at the gate, the driver elected to take a different path to the city. We drove round to the back of the prison, and our convoy took small roads and byways into town. We drove through beautiful green vineyards and manicured farms, and I relished the scenery around me. The countryside was lush and well cared for, but what surprised me was how many white families were standing beside the road to get a glimpse of our motorcade. They had heard on the radio that we were taking an alternate route. Some, perhaps a dozen, even raised their clenched right fists in what had become the ANC power salute. This astonished me. I was tremendously encouraged by these few brave souls from a conservative farming area who expressed their solidarity. At one point, I stopped and got out of the car to greet and thank one such white family and tell them how inspired I was by their support. It made me think that the South Africa I was returning to was far different from the one I had left. As we entered the outskirts of the city, I could see people streaming toward the center. The reception committee had organized a rally at the Grand Parade in Cape Town, a great open square that stretched out in front of the old city hall. I would speak to the crowd from the balcony of that building, which overlooked the entire area. We heard sketchy reports that a great sea of people had been waiting there since morning. The plan was for our motorcade to avoid the crowd and drive around to the back of City Hall, where I would quietly enter the building. The drive to Cape Town took 45 minutes, and as we neared the Grand Parade, we could see an enormous crowd. The driver was meant to turn right and skirt its edges, but instead he inexplicably plunged straight into the sea of people. Immediately the crowd surged forward and enveloped the car. We inched forward for a minute or two, but were then forced to stop by the sheer press of bodies. People began knocking on the windows, and then on the boot and the bonnet. Inside, it sounded like a massive hailstorm. Then people began to jump on the car in their excitement. Others began to shake it, and at that moment, I began to worry. I felt as though the crowd might very well kill us with their love. The driver was even more anxious than Winnie and I, and he was clamoring to jump out of the car. I told him to stay calm and remain inside, that others from the cars behind us would come to our rescue. Alan Bosek and others began to attempt to clear a way for our vehicle and push the people off the car, but with little success. We sat inside. It would have been futile to even attempt to open the door, so many people were pressing on it. For more than an hour, imprisoned by thousands of our own supporters, the scheduled beginning of the speech had long passed. Several dozen marshals eventually came to the rescue and managed slowly to clear an exit path. When we finally broke free, the driver set off at great speed in the opposite direction from City Hall. "Man, where are you going?" I asked him in some agitation. "I don't know," he said, his voice tense with anxiety. "I've never experienced anything like that before," he said, and then continued driving without any destination in mind. When he began to calm down, I gave him directions to the house of my friend and attorney, Dalla Omar, who lived in the Indian area of the city. "We could go there," I said, "and relax for a few minutes." This appealed to him. Fortunately, Dalla and his family were home, but they were more than a bit surprised to see us. I was a free man for the first time in 27 years, but instead of greeting me, they said with some concern, "Aren't you meant to be at the Grand Parade?" We were able to sip some cold drinks at Dulles, but we had only been there a few minutes when Archbishop Tutu telephoned. How he knew we were there, I do not know. He was quite distressed and said, "Nelson, you must come back to the Grand Parade immediately. The people are growing restless. If you do not return straight away, I cannot vouch for what will happen. I think there might be an uprising." I said I would return at once. Our problem was the driver. He was deeply reluctant to return to the Grand Parade. But I remonstrated with him, and soon we were on our way back to City Hall. The building was surrounded by people on all sides, but it was not as dense in the back, and the driver managed to make his way through to the rear entrance. It was almost dusk when I was led up to the top floor of this stately building, whose halls had always been filled with shuffling white functionaries. I walked out onto the balcony and saw a boundless sea of people cheering, holding flags and banners, clapping and laughing. I raised my fist to the crowd, and the crowd responded with an enormous cheer. Those cheers fired me anew with the spirit of the struggle. "Amandla," I called out. "Ngoetu," they responded. "Afrika," I yelled. "Mayebuye," they answered. Finally, when the crowd had settled down a bit, I took out my speech and then reached into my breast pocket for my glasses. They were not there. I had left them at Victor Förster. I knew Winnie's glasses were a similar prescription, and I borrowed hers. "Friends, comrades, and fellow South Africans, I greet you all in the name of peace, democracy, and freedom for all. I stand here before you not as a prophet, but as a humble servant of you, the people. Your tireless and heroic sacrifices have made it possible for me to be here today. I therefore place the remaining years of my life in your hands." I spoke from the heart. I wanted first of all to tell the people that I was not a Messiah, but an ordinary man who had become a leader because of extraordinary circumstances. I wanted immediately to thank the people all over the world who had campaigned for my release. I thanked the people of Cape Town, and I saluted Oliver Tambo and the African National Congress, Umkhonto Wesizwe, the South African Communist Party, the UDF, the South African Youth Congress, COSATU, the Mass Democratic Movement, the National Union of South African Students, and the Black Sash, a group formed by women that had long been a voice of conscience. I also publicly expressed my gratitude to my wife and family, saying, I am convinced that their pain and suffering was far greater than my own. I told the crowd in no uncertain terms that apartheid had no future in South Africa, and that the people must not let up their campaign of mass action. The sight of freedom looming on the horizon should encourage us to redouble our efforts. I felt it was important publicly to explain my talks with the government. Today, I said, I wish to report to you that my talks with the government have been aimed at normalizing the political situation in the country. I wish to stress that I myself have at no time entered into negotiations about the future of our country except to insist on a meeting between the ANC and the government. I said I hoped that a climate conducive to a negotiated settlement could soon be achieved, ending the need for the armed struggle. The steps to achieving such a climate, I said, had been outlined in the ANC's 1989 Harare Declaration. As a condition to real negotiations, I said, the government must immediately end the state of emergency and free all political prisoners. I told the people that de Klerk had gone further than any other nationalist leader to normalize the situation, and then, in words that came back to haunt me, I called Mr. de Klerk a man of integrity. These words were flung back at me many times when Mr. de Klerk seemed not to live up to them. It was vital for me to show my people and the government that I was unbroken and unbowed, and that the struggle was not over for me, but beginning anew in a different form. I affirmed that I was a loyal and disciplined member of the African National Congress. I encouraged the people to return to the barricades, to intensify the struggle, and we would walk the last mile together. It was evening by the time my speech was finished, and we were hustled back into our cars for the trip to Bishop's Court. As we entered its pristine environs, I saw hundreds of black faces waiting to greet me. When they saw us, the people burst into song. When I greeted Archbishop Tutu, I enveloped him in a great hug. Here was a man who had inspired an entire nation with his words and his courage, who had revived the people's hope during the darkest of times. We were led inside the house where more family and friends met us. But for me, the most wonderful moment was when I was told that I had a telephone call from Stockholm. I knew immediately who it was. Oliver's voice was weak, but unmistakable, and to hear him after all those years filled me with great joy. Oliver was in Sweden, recuperating from a debilitating stroke he had suffered in August 1989. We agreed that we would meet as soon as possible. My dream upon leaving prison was to take a leisurely drive down to the Transkei and visit my birthplace, the hills and streams where I had played as a boy, and the burial ground of my mother, which I had never seen. But my dream had to be deferred, for I learned very quickly of the extensive plans that the ANC had for me, and none of them involved a relaxing journey to the Transkei. Chapter 101. I was scheduled to hold a press conference the afternoon after my release, and in the morning I met with a number of my colleagues to talk about scheduling and strategy. A small mountain of telegrams and messages of congratulations had arrived, and I tried to review as many of these as possible. There were telegrams from all around the world, from presidents and prime ministers. But I remember one in particular from a white Cape Town housewife that amused me greatly. It read, "I am very glad that you are free and that you are back among your friends and family. But your speech yesterday was very boring." Before I went to prison, I never held such a press conference as I did that day. In the old days, there were no television cameras, and most ANC press conferences were conducted clandestinely. That afternoon, there were so many journalists from so many different countries, I did not know whom to speak with. I was pleased to see a high percentage of black journalists among the throng. At the press conference, I was once again keen to reassert a number of themes. First, that I was a loyal and disciplined member of the ANC. I was mindful of the fact that the most senior ANC people would be watching my release from abroad and attempting to gauge my fidelity from a distance. I was aware that they had heard rumors that I had strayed from the organization, that I was compromised, so at every turn I sought to reassure them. When asked what role I would play in the organization, I told the press that I would play whatever role the ANC ordered. I told the reporters that there was no contradiction between my continuing support for the armed struggle and my advocating negotiations. It was the reality and the threat of the armed struggle that had brought the government to the verge of negotiations. I added that when the state stopped inflicting violence on the ANC, the ANC would reciprocate with peace. Asked about sanctions, I said the ANC could not yet call for the relaxation of sanctions because the situation that caused sanctions in the first place, the absence of political rights for blacks, was still the status quo. I might be out of jail, I said, but I was not yet free. I was asked as well about the fears of whites. I knew that people expected me to harbor anger toward whites, but I had none. In prison, my anger toward whites decreased, but my hatred for the system grew. I wanted South Africa to see that I loved even my enemies while I hated the system that turned us against one another. I wanted to impress upon the reporters the critical role of whites in any new dispensation. I have tried never to lose sight of this. We did not want to destroy the country before we freed it, and to drive the whites away would devastate the nation. I said that there was a middle ground between white fears and black hopes, and we in the ANC would find it. "Whites are fellow South Africans," I said, "and we want them to feel safe and to know that we appreciate the contribution that they have made toward the development of this country. Any man or woman who abandons apartheid will be embraced in our struggle for a democratic, non-racial South Africa. We must do everything we can to persuade our white compatriots that a new, non-racial South Africa will be a better place for all." From my very first press conference, I noticed that journalists were as eager to learn about my personal feelings and relationships as my political thoughts. This was new to me. When I went to prison, a journalist would never have thought of asking questions about one's wife and family, one's emotions, one's most intimate moments. While it was understandable that the press might be interested in these things, I nevertheless found their curiosity difficult to satisfy. I am not and never have been a man who finds it easy to talk about his feelings in public. I was often asked by reporters how it felt to be free, and I did my best to describe the indescribable, and usually failed. After the press conference, Archbishop Tutu's wife telephoned us from Johannesburg to say that we must fly there straight away. Winnie and I had hoped to spend a few days in Cape Town relaxing, but the message we were getting was that the people of Johannesburg were getting restless, and there might be chaos if I did not return directly. We flew to Johannesburg that evening, but I was informed that there were thousands of people surrounding our old home, 8115 Orlando West, which had been reconstructed, and that it would be unwise to go there. I reluctantly acceded. I yearned to spend my second night of freedom under my own roof. Instead, Winnie and I stayed in the northern suburbs at the home of an ANC supporter. The following morning, we flew by helicopter to the First National Bank Stadium in Soweto. We were able to make an aerial tour of Soweto, the teeming metropolis of matchbox houses, tin shanties, and dirt roads, the mother city of black urban South Africa, the only home I ever knew as a man before I went to prison. While Soweto had grown, and in some places prospered, the overwhelming majority of the people remained dreadfully poor, without electricity or running water, eking out an existence that was shameful in a nation as wealthy as South Africa. In many places, the poverty was far worse than when I went to prison. We circled over the stadium, overflowing with 120,000 people, and landed in the center. The stadium was so crowded with people sitting or standing in every inch of space that it looked as though it would burst. I expressed my delight to be back among them, but I then scolded the people for some of the crippling problems of urban black life. Students, I said, must return to school. Crime must be brought under control. I told them that I had heard of criminals masquerading as freedom fighters, harassing innocent people and setting alight vehicles. These rogues had no place in the struggle. Freedom without civility, freedom without the ability to live in peace, was not true freedom at all. Today, my return to Soweto fills my heart with joy. At the same time, I also return with a deep sense of sadness. Sadness to learn that you are still suffering under an inhuman system. The housing shortage, the schools crisis, unemployment and the crime rate still remain. As proud as I am to be part of the Soweto community, I have been greatly disturbed by the statistics of crime that I read in the newspapers. Although I understand the deprivations our people suffer, I must make it clear that the level of crime in the township is unhealthy and must be eliminated as a matter of urgency. I ended by opening my arms to all South Africans of goodwill and good intentions, saying that no man or woman who has abandoned apartheid will be excluded from our movement toward a non-racial, united and democratic South Africa based on one person, one vote on a common voter's roll. That was the ANC's mission, the goal that I had always kept before me during the many lonely years in prison, the goal that I would work toward during the remaining years of my life. It was the dream I cherished when I entered prison at the age of 44, but I was no longer a young man. I was 71, and I could not afford to waste any time. That night, I returned with Winnie to number 8115 in Orlando West. It was only then that I knew in my heart that I had left prison. For me, 8115 was the center point of my world, the place marked with an X in my mental geography. The house had been soundly rebuilt after the fire. When I saw the four-roomed house, I was surprised by how much smaller and humbler it was than I remembered it being. Compared to my cottage at Victor Firster, number 8115 could have been the servants' quarters at the back. But any house in which a man is free is a castle when compared to even the plushest prison. That night, as happy as I was to be home, I had a sense that what I most wanted and longed for was going to be denied me. I yearned to resume a normal and ordinary life, to pick up some of the old threads from my life as a young man, to be able to go to my office in the morning and return to my family in the evening, to be able to pop out and buy some toothpaste at the pharmacy, to visit in the evening with old friends. These ordinary things are what one misses most in prison and dreams about doing when one is free. But I quickly realized that such things were not going to be possible. That night, and every night for the next weeks and months, the house was surrounded by hundreds of well-wishers. People sang and danced and called out, and their joy was infectious. These were my people, and I had no right and no desire to deny myself to them. But in giving myself to my people, I could see that I was once again taking myself away from my family. We did not sleep much that night, as the singing continued until the early hours, when members of the ANC and UDF who were guarding the house begged the crowd to remain quiet and allow us to rest. There were many in the ANC who advised me to move to the home a few blocks distant, in Deep Kloof Extension, that Winnie had built while I was in prison. It was a grand place by Soweto standards, but it was a house that held no meaning or memories for me. Moreover, it was a house that, because of its size and expense, seemed somehow inappropriate for a leader of the people. I rejected that advice for as long as I could. I wanted not only to live among my people, but like them. Chapter 102. My first responsibility was to report to the leadership of the ANC, and on February 27th, when I had been out of prison a little over 2 weeks, I flew to Lusaka for a meeting of the National Executive Committee. It was a wonderful reunion to be with old comrades whom I had not seen in decades. A number of African heads of state were also in attendance, and I had brief talks with Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, Kenneth Konda of Zambia, José Eduardo dos Santos of Angola, Kwet Masia of Botswana, Joaquim Chissano of Mozambique, and Yoweri Museveni of Uganda. While the members of the executive were pleased that I had been freed, they were also eager to evaluate the men who had been released. I could see the questions in their eyes. Was Mandela the same man who went to prison 27 years before? Or was this a different Mandela, a reformed Mandela? Had he survived, or had he been broken? They had heard reports of my conversations with the government, and they were rightly concerned. I had not only been out of touch with the situation on the ground since 1984, I had not even been able to communicate with my colleagues in prison. I carefully and soberly explained the nature of my talks with the government. I described the demands I had made and the progress that had been achieved. They had seen the memoranda I had written to Botha and de Klerk and knew that these documents adhered to ANC policy. I knew that over the previous years some of the men who had been released had gone to Lusaka and whispered, "Madiba has become soft. He has been bought off by the authorities. He is wearing three-piece suits, drinking wine and eating fine food." I knew of these whispers, and I intended to refute them. I knew that the best way to disprove them was simply to be direct and honest about everything that I had done. At that session of the NEC, I was elected deputy president of the organization, while Alfred Nzo, the organization's secretary general, was named acting president while Oliver was recuperating. At a press conference after our meeting, I was asked about a suggestion made by Dr. Konda, the president of Zambia and a longtime supporter of the Congress, that the ANC should suspend armed operations inside South Africa now that I had been released. I replied that while we valued Mr. Konda's wisdom and support, it was too soon to suspend the armed struggle, for we had not yet achieved the goal for which we took up arms. It was not the ANC's job, I said, to help Mr. de Klerk placate his right-wing supporters. I began a tour of Africa, which included many countries. During the first 6 months after my release, I spent more time abroad than at home. Nearly everywhere I went, there were great, enthusiastic crowds, so that even if I felt weary, the people buoyed me. In Dar es Salaam, I was met by a crowd estimated at 500,000. I enjoyed my travels immensely. I wanted to see new and old sights, taste different foods, speak with all manner of people. I very quickly had to acclimatize myself to a world radically different from the one I had left. With changes in travel, communication, and mass media, the world had accelerated. Things now happened so fast it was sometimes difficult to keep up with them. Winnie tried to get me to slow down, but there was simply too much to do. The organization wanted to make sure we took advantage of the euphoria generated by my release. In Cairo, the day after a private meeting with the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, I was scheduled to address a large meeting in a local hall. When I arrived, the crowd seemed to be spilling out of the building and there was precious little security. I mentioned to a policeman that I thought he needed reinforcements, but he merely shrugged. Winnie and I waited in a room behind the hall, and at the appointed hour, a policeman motioned for me to go in. I told him to escort the rest of my delegation in first because I feared that when I went in there would be pandemonium and they would be cut off. But the policeman urged me to go first, and indeed, as soon as I was in the hall, the crowd surged forward and overcame the cordon of policemen. In their enthusiasm, I was jostled and a bit shaken, and at one point I lost my shoe in the general confusion. When things began to calm down a few minutes later, I found that neither my shoe nor my wife could be located. Finally, after nearly half an hour, Winnie was brought onto the stage with me, quite cross that she had been lost. I was not able to even address the crowd, for they were shouting, "Mandela! Mandela!" so furiously that I could not be heard above the din. And finally I left, without my shoe, and with an uncharacteristically silent wife. While in Cairo, I held a press conference at which I said the ANC was prepared to consider a cessation of hostilities. This was a signal to the government. Both the ANC and the government were engaged in creating a climate whereby negotiations would succeed. While the ANC was demanding that the government normalize the situation in the country by ending the state of emergency, releasing all political prisoners, and repealing all apartheid laws, the government was intent on first persuading the ANC to suspend the armed struggle. While we were not yet ready to announce such a suspension, we wanted to provide Mr. de Klerk with enough encouragement to pursue his reformist strategies. We knew that we would eventually suspend the armed struggle, in part to facilitate more serious negotiations, and in part to allow Mr. de Klerk to go to his own constituency, the white voters of South Africa, and say, "Look, here are the fruits of my policy." After my last stop in Africa, I flew to Stockholm to visit Oliver. Seeing my old friend and law partner was the reunion I most looked forward to. Oliver was not well, but when we met we were like two young boys in the veld who took strength from our love for each other. We began by talking of old times, but when we were alone, the first subject he raised was the leadership of the organization. "Nelson," he said, "you must now take over as president of the ANC. I have been merely keeping the job warm for you." I refused, telling him that he had led the organization in exile far better than I ever could have. It was neither fair nor democratic for a transfer to occur in such a manner. "You have been elected by the organization as the president," I said. "Let us wait for an election. Then the organization can decide." Oliver protested, but I would not budge. It was a sign of his humility and selflessness that he wanted to appoint me president, but it was not in keeping with the principles of the ANC. In April 1990, I flew to London to attend a concert at Wembley, held in my honor. Many international artists, most of whom I never knew, were performing, and the event was to be televised worldwide. I took advantage of this to thank the world's anti-apartheid forces for the tremendous work they had done in pressing for sanctions, for the release of myself and fellow political prisoners, and for the genuine support and solidarity they had shown the oppressed people of my country. Chapter 103. When I emerged from prison, Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi, the head of the Inkatha Freedom Party and the chief minister of KwaZulu, was one of the premier players on the South African political stage. But within ANC circles, he was a far from popular figure. Chief Buthelezi was descended from the great Zulu king Cetshwayo, who had defeated the British at the Battle of Isandlwana in 1879. As a young man, he attended Fort Hare and then joined the ANC Youth League. I saw him as one of the movement's upcoming young leaders. He had become chief minister of the KwaZulu homeland with the tacit support of the ANC, and even his launching of INCATA as a Zulu cultural organization was unopposed by the organization. But over the years, Chief Buthelezi drifted away from the ANC. Though he resolutely opposed apartheid and refused to allow KwaZulu to become an independent homeland as the government wished, he was a thorn in the side of the democratic movement. He opposed the armed struggle. He criticized the 1976 Soweto uprising. He campaigned against international sanctions. He challenged the idea of a unitary state of South Africa. Yet Chief Buthelezi had consistently called for my release and refused to negotiate with the government until I and other political prisoners were liberated. Chief Buthelezi was one of the first people I telephoned after my release to thank him for his long-standing support. My inclination was to meet with the chief as soon as possible to try to resolve our differences. During my initial visit to Lusaka, I brought up the idea of such a meeting, and it was voted down. While I was at Victor Verster, Walter had been invited by the Zulu king, Goodwill Zwelithini, to visit him in Ulundi, KwaZulu's capital, and I urged him to accept. I thought it was an excellent opportunity to influence the head of one of the most respected and powerful royal families in the country. The visit was tentatively approved by the NEC, provided Walter went to the king's palace in Nongoma. It was thought that going to Ulundi would suggest recognition of the authority of the homeland. When I returned from Lusaka, I telephoned both Chief Buthelezi and the king and explained that Walter would be coming to see the king not in Ulundi, but at Nongoma. The king said he would not accept Walter coming to see him anywhere else but in the capital. "I am the king," he said. "I have invited him to see me in Ulundi, and he has no right to say I will see you elsewhere." "Your Majesty," I said, "we are facing a wall of opposition from our membership who did not want Mr. Sisulu to go to KwaZulu at all. We managed to get this compromise approved. Surely you can bend as well." But he could not, and he refused to see Walter. Relations deteriorated after this, and in May I persuaded the ANC of the need for me to make a visit to the king and Buthelezi. The king approved, but a week or so before the visit I received a letter from him saying I must come alone. This proved to be the last straw, and the NEC would not give in to such a demand. I told the king that I could not come unless I was accompanied by my colleagues. The king regarded this as another slight and cancelled the visit. My goal was to forge an independent relationship with the king, separate from my relationship with Chief Buthelezi. The king was the true hereditary leader of the Zulus, who loved and respected him. Fidelity to the king was far more widespread in KwaZulu than allegiance to INCATA. In the meantime, Natal became a killing ground. Heavily armed INCATA supporters had in effect declared war on ANC strongholds across the Natal Midlands region and around Pietermaritzburg. Entire villages were set alight, dozens of people were killed, hundreds were wounded, and thousands became refugees. In March 1990 alone, 230 people lost their lives in this internecine violence. In Natal, Zulu was murdering Zulu, for INCATA members and ANC partisans are Zulus. In February, only 2 weeks after my release, I went to Durban and spoke to a crowd of over 100,000 people at King's Park, almost all of whom were Zulus. I pleaded with them to lay down their arms, to take each other's hands in peace. "Take your guns, your knives, and your pangas, and throw them into the sea. Close down the death factories. End this war now." But my call fell on deaf ears. The fighting and dying continued. I was so concerned that I was willing to go to great lengths to meet Chief Buthelezi. In March, after one particularly horrifying spasm of violence, I announced on my own that I would meet Chief Buthelezi at a mountain hamlet outside of Pietermaritzburg. On a personal level, my relations with Chief Buthelezi were close and respectful, and I hoped to capitalize on that. But I found that such a meeting was anathema to ANC leaders in Natal. They considered it dangerous and vetoed my meeting. I did go to Peter